autumn in New York. It spells the thrill of first nighting. Glittering crowds and shimmering clouds in canyons of steel. This autumn in New York, it brings the promise of new love. Autumn in New York is often mingled with pain. Dreamers with empty hands for exotic lands, but autumn in New York, it's good to live it again. Lovers who bless the dark on benches in Central Park greet autumn in New York. It is good to live it again.
Autumn in New York by Vernon Duke. It was sung by Sir Richard Rodney Bennett, who died last Monday. Well, that's all for another Sunday morning. Thanks for your company throughout 2012. Rob and I have enjoyed playing you some of our favourite music, and we've lots more where that came from lined up for 2013. So have an enjoyable remainder of this long weekend and a very happy, healthy and musical new year from me, James Jolly. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, and today's studio producer was Lyndon Jones. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The journalist and broadcaster Simon Hoggart writes for The Guardian. He currently contributes sketches and a weekly diary, and on wine for The Spectator. He joined The Guardian in 1968, and in the 80s he chaired the news quiz, memorably, if I may say so, Simon, on Radio 4, because that must have been great fun for you.
Oh, I absolutely adored it. I did resign in there, but I think they'd have fired me anyway because they wanted a slightly more show-busy show, which they've got, and I never miss it even now. But, oh, it was just wonderful to sit there in the middle with people like Alan Corran and Jeremy Hardy and Andy Hamilton and Linda Smith, and, oh, some of the most brilliant comics in the country, just gigging, basically, rapping, whatever the word is, you know. Sometimes the most hilarious stuff would just come as they followed a train of thought until it hit the buffers, you know. Absolutely marvellous. And I look back on those times very, very warmly indeed.
I think with broadcasting, very often, if you're having great fun doing it, there's at least a reasonably good chance that the listener will enjoy hearing it. And it should at its best rather be like sitting at an adjoining table and rather wishing that you could be at the one that you're eavesdropping on.
Except the nice thing is that you do feel that you're personally being addressed at like the adjoining table where it's not meant for your ears. This is. And people still quote back to me jokes they've heard. I remember Linda Smith, for example, saying, "I come from Erith." It's not twinned with anywhere, but it does have a suicide pact with Dagenham.
You've put together many books of writings of all different kinds. I think probably Life's Too Short to Drink Bad Wine was probably your first book on wine, wasn't it?
It was, yes. Mm. And my only book on wine. I just kind of fed up with wine snobs. You know, wine snob, and there aren't very many of them. They're a great hate figure, but in some ways a straw man, really. But you do meet them, and they're people who, like social snobs, are much more interested in what's on the cover, what's on the label, and its status than what's in the bottle. And so what I was trying to do is to find wines that I think are terrific value, but also delicious to taste, and write about them in terms of enjoyment. So a lot of people treat wine as if it was some kind of exam. You've got to be brilliant at recognising a Burgundy or knowing which bank of the Gironde this particular claret comes from. That's all nonsense. You know, the only thing that matters really is the taste. And if you're interested in finding out a bit more, then that's great too. But you don't have to. And the other thing is too that I've been doing the wine column in The Spectator for 11 years now, and the stuff has just got better and better. World competition is ferocious now, and technology is improving all the time at a stupendous rate. So one of the best Burgundies I've ever had was grown in Bulgaria, for example. Now, that would not have been true 12 years ago, but what a joy to find something that tastes as good as a real Burgundy at £9.95 a bottle.
Well, we'll come on to wine later, because we're here to discuss, of course, your other passion, which is music. I think your parents really introduced you to the first piece.
They loved music, and the thing was that I was a child at a time when it became accessible to everyone, really. There was a label, I think Decca, called Ace of Clubs, and they put out just about every great piece of music there was on LPs, vinyl LPs for the first time. And before that, I remember having to turn over 78s every couple of minutes or so, it seemed. And suddenly you could listen to a whole symphony, turning the thing only once, and it was 21 shillings. It was actually quite a lot of money then, but it was affordable. And we had this family tradition that on Sunday nights we would listen to a really nice piece of music, a very accessible one. No Stockhausen, for example, and John Cage was a stranger to my parents' turntable, but Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, etc. It was a complete joy, it really was, and one of my happiest childhood memories.
And Eine kleine Nacht Musik?
Eine kleine Nacht Musik was one of them. I know it's a cliched choice. I don't mind. It's just the most beautiful piece of music. And it's, Bernard Levin once wrote an article in which he proposed a sainthood for Mozart. He said, OK, he wasn't a martyr. He wasn't particularly religious. In many ways, he was a scamp. But he did more to make the world a happier place than just about any saint ever did. And he should be chosen by the Pope.
Thank you.
Imagine being in Salzburg and listening to that for the first time. Every bar is familiar to us now, but the thrill people must have had. I went to Salzburg during a Mozart festival years ago as a student and went to a concert. They were terrible. One of the worst concerts I've ever been to, my friend, and I walked out in the interval.
You were saying how pieces like that can become slightly cliché-ridden in a sense, but the funny thing is that some pieces... And I'm thinking, for example, when I was a child and Malcolm Sargent, do you remember Flash Harry at the proms? And a lot of the pieces that he did then, for example, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, César Franck, Symphonic Variations, Rachmaninoff, Piano Concerto No. 2, became so burdened by that cliche that actually they sort of disappeared for a while and you didn't hear them. So listening to that again, I actually find it rather refreshing.
Good.
Excellent. It's like hearing something... Well, one did know it, of course, but hadn't heard it for a while.
Excellent. I love collecting jokes that musicians tell, and one of them is about the violin chat player who comes back home after the concert, and his wife says, who was conducting? He says, I don't know, I didn't look.
Well, I imagine the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields managed an upward glance to Neville Mariner there as he was conducting the Allegro from the Mozart Eine kleine Nachtmusik, Kirkel 5. Five. Your father was a very distinguished sociologist.
Very distinguished indeed. It was extraordinary. He came back from America, where we lived when I was a boy, for a year, and came back. The Use of Literacy had just been published, and suddenly he was, in a small way, quite famous, and later became even more famous, of course, when he gave evidence for Penguin Books at the trial of Lady Chatterley, the famous Would You Want Your Wife or Your Servants to Read This Book trial.
He had a wonderful mind, your dad. Must have been a very inspiring figure.
Well, yes, he was a wonderful dad too. That was the other thing. He always left his study door open so you could always go in. He never said, oh, I'm far too busy. Whether you were going in, what did your bottom wiping if you were 1 year old or if you needed to borrow some money. He was a terrific dad in that way. And he'd been orphaned himself at a very early age. And I think he wanted to give us the kind of warm, cosy parental care that he'd missed himself so desperately. And he succeeded triumphantly, I think.
Well, as well as Mozart from those early days, there was Beethoven. And in particular, I think, the Pastoral Symphony.
Well, that was the one that stuck in my head. I mean, again, every Beethoven symphony, every bar is familiar to all of us, I suppose. But this one I always think has a particularly beautiful opening, and it runs through my mind at unexpected times.
Part of the opening movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F Major, Opus 68, the Pastoral. We heard the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Klaus Tennstedt. One of the reasons, Simon, we thought that you would enjoy doing this programme is that reading your diary quite often in The Guardian, you mention visits to concerts and opera.
Yes, they do stand out. And I went to King's College, Cambridge, which then as now took a lot of state school pupils, so I think to some extent we ticked a box for them. Extraordinary college, many very left-wing, fighting bravely to defeat the notion that it was entirely homosexual, gay college, by a fairly aggressive heterosexuality. We were even shown how to climb into college after hours so that we could visit lady friends, if we were lucky enough to have any. There was a great shortage of women in Cambridge at that time. And of course, along with this, you've got the chapel and this extraordinary choir, which is slightly unfair, I think, on, for example, St. John's Choir nearby, which is probably almost as good, but King's has the name, and you would see all those little boys in their top hats being frog-marched across the street and into the back of the college to perform at services. Pretty rough on the choir, you know. They had to be on deck on Christmas Day morning. So apparently on Christmas Day there'd be anxious parents waiting outside, ready to race them off to have a late Christmas dinner. Very hard on the ones who lived in, say, Scotland. Anyway, that meant that you could go, if you wanted to, a service and hear this amazing music in the chapel, and then come back, and being students, you'd go to a party and drink too much and be bopping away to the Rolling Stones or deconstructing the new Beatles LP with all the care an English literature student might give to Ulysses or Chaucer.
One of the pieces you heard, and it does always make an astonishing impression, is the 40-part motet Sperminalium by Thomas Tallis. Do you remember that clearly?
Oh, yes, it's extraordinary. But it's, beginning is a real hairs on the back of your neck standing on end piece, rather like the first verse of Once in Royal David's City that starts the service of Nine Lessons and Carols. It's a real goose pimply moment. I think that was just thrilling. My daughter, our daughter, went to King's as well, and she reported that if you wanted a really rumbustious, boozy night out, which would be a lot of fun, the choir were the ones to go with. The undergraduates, of course, not the little boys.
Yes, that was the wonderful 40-part motet, Speminalium, by Thomas Tallis. The choir of King's College, Cambridge, directed by Stephen Clebury, and the organ scholar was Peter Stevens. Very good cellar, I'm reliably told, at King's.
Yes, there's a chap called Pete de Boller, who's Director of Studies in English. Wasn't there when I was there, unfortunately, but I've got to know him since. And he does have the most amazing cellar and a wonderful taste for wine. And, of course, all these colleges, and King's is no exception, are short of money these days for usual reasons. But what he does is use his instinct for good wine to buy up lots, sell it at a profit to outsiders, not to anyone, really, and that means that the college drinks free.
Actually, Simon Hoggart, funnily enough, I was in Brazil recently and I went to, it was kind of a sculpture park, quite an extraordinary place. And it was called, it was an installation called the 40-part motet by Janet Cardiff, the Canadian installation artist. And it consisted of 40 speakers in a large circle in a rather wonderful space. And you walked round just in front of these speakers, and so you heard each of the individual 40 singers. And then, of course, as you went into the middle of the circle, you'd get the effect of the combination of all of them together. And it was magical. It
must have been wonderful. I'd love to hear that. I'll need to buy 38 speakers on my way home.
Now, you've made my day, I think, speaking as a composer, by actually choosing a work by a living composer.
Well, there is a story behind this, yes. Piers Helliwell was an old friend, and it dates from the days when I was a correspondent in America for The Observer, and I got invited to the Conference on World Affairs in Boulder, Colorado, which sounds immensely grand, but is basically a piss-up with speeches. And one of the people who used to go there was Piers Helliwell as a composer, and he knew a lot of the other musicians there, and his wife, Jerry, from Belfast. And he's one of the warmest, funniest men I've ever met. And we've remained very good friends, and I love going to his concerts. I first saw this piece produced at the Proms, and Piers said he didn't want to sit with us because listening to an orchestra interpret your work could be a very painful experience for a composer, not because the orchestra were incompetent, they're very, very good, but because it's not quite what you had in your head when you were writing the piece down, so you're listening to the differences. And I can understand that. As if you write an article you're pleased with, it's horrible if it's repunctuated or something like that. And he was sitting in sort of throes of agony as the music passed him, twisting himself and tapping himself on the knee and frowning and generally moving around. And the chap next to him was clearly quite cross, as people sometimes do get at concerts, and throwing him really very angry looks. And at the end, Colin Davis beckoned him to come up to the platform, and the look of astonishment on his neighbour's face when he realised that he had been sitting next to the composer was, Piers said, an absolute joy to behold.
And what did it speak to you of, this piece? What did you like about it?
May sound pretentious. They have a home in the Western Isles on Harris, and somehow I was taken back there. Not I've ever been to Harris, I've been to various Scottish islands, but that sense of water trickling over stones, the sea in the background, it's very allied to nature. It's also quite challenging music, you have to be open and honest about that. I remember having Piers and his wife to dinner once when they were in London, and asked him to play just something that would amuse the kids. And he did a version of Roll Out the Barrel with the most extraordinary variations with his right hand and a thumping rhythm with his left hand. And I thought, right, you can do it. It's a bit like learning that Damien Hirst can also paint a Constable-style landscape. I thought, fine, you've proved it.
That was part of the opening vivace from Piers Hellowell's Inside Story. We heard Cleo Gould playing the violin, Philip Dukes the viola, and the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra conducted by Martin Brabbins. There was, I thought, there very much a feeling of waves building and breaking. Simon Hoggart.
Yes, it is challenging, but I find that, as with a lot of modern music, it repays re-listening, and we basically need to get our brains adjusted. And it's a cliche, isn't it, how many great works were greeted with boos when they were first performed.
When you were working on The Observer, I think you were taken, well, actually, to a rather wonderful place. You went to Berlin, and that prompted your choice of the next piece, I think.
Yes, there was a conference in Berlin, and the editor of The Observer, then Donald Trelford, wanted me to go along with him. And I thought, well, you know, I believe you can go into East Berlin. It's not a problem. The war was still very much there. And it was extremely easy. You paid your subway fare, and although it was elevated at that point, you went over the wall and into Berlin, East Berlin. And I looked around, and it all looked rather dowdy, and compared to the incredible lush prosperity that anyone who's been to modern Germany is familiar with. It was getting out that was the problem. Of course, I hadn't realised that or hadn't taken it on board. And they really were very, very... It took about an hour, even with a British passport, clearly no knowledge of German at all, pretty good English. And finally, after about an hour arguing with these people, they decided I was not an East German fleeing to West Germany, and they let me go. And I got out just in time to go to the Staats Opera, where Donald had booked tickets for Berlioz's Faust. And I must say, well, maybe it was something to do with relief at getting out of the clutches of the Red Hordes, but I think it was just the music which absolutely thrilled me.
And especially the closing pages, the ending.
The very end, the Assumption of Marguerite, when she goes up to heaven, unlike poor old Faust, of course. I've noticed that all my last three choices are vocal, and there is something about the human voice that brings a sort of tingle of excitement, I think, to a piece of music which you never quite get with purely orchestral music. Perhaps that's just me, I don't know.
It's interesting, the sort of use of the lapping harp underneath those flowing voices. Again, have a feeling of water about it. The Assumption of Marguerite from The Damnation of Faust, Part 4 by Berlioz. We heard Eton College Boys Choir, the Philharmonia Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Myung Won Chung. Simon, having observed over the years the antics of the people that represent us and make our laws, have you come to any particular conclusions?
I remember the first day I went to work in the House of Commons, which was, I hate to think of it now, 1973. And on my first day, I thought, A, this is one of the most fascinating places I've ever been. It's office politics, but on the grandest possible scale. Really, is who was seen behind the water cooler, who's plotting against X, but was overheard in the laboratory, that sort of thing. But as I say, in a way that affects all our lives, where our children are educated, how much tax we pay, whether we go to war and so on. So absolutely fascinating. But the other decision I made on that first day was I don't want to be an MP. I just can't imagine ever having one's thoughts and writing and speaking so horribly restricted as it is. You know how on a phone-in programme on the radio you have a thing called the seven-second loop, so if someone swears or says something libelous, they can be cut out before it's actually broadcast. And MPs have that in their heads all the time. Whenever they speak to you, unless it's just telling the latest joke they've picked up, then you can almost see the seven-second loop, thinking, is this going to get me in trouble with my party leader or the whips or my constituents or some special interest group that can make my life very, very difficult. So I've never wanted to be an MP, but I've loved working down there.
Donizetti at Glyndebourne fired your imagination recently.
Yes, I go to Glyndebourne when we can. It's very expensive, but I've got to the age and state of being clapped out that I'm at already, realising that one thing you would have to invest in is memories, actually. And I've never been to Glyndebourne without having an absolutely marvellous time. The music, obviously, but the picnics and the friendship of very good friends, and, of course, the wine. I used to make a point of taking down the wine. And I have to say that halfway through, you've heard some fabulous music in the opera house there. You're sitting, if you're lucky, on a glorious English summer day with a fabulous view of the downs. You're eating delicious food, drinking scrumptious wine, and you know you've got another hour and a half of glorious music to follow. It doesn't get any better than that.
And this Donizetti aria in particular, Una Furtiva Lagrima, a very famous aria.
I know, but I hadn't heard it until I heard it at Glyndebourne. And it was one of those rare days at Glyndebourne, perhaps not that rare this last year, in which it poured with rain throughout and the Elixir of Love is performed in a sun-soaked Italian village square with the lighting conveying the blasting heat that all the villagers are suffering from. So we would go out to this thunder and rain sluicing down. It wasn't even in drops, it was just coming down in sheets. But that probably made the beauty of this particular aria even greater.
Thank you.
When we began that, I dare say some people listening might be thinking, why are they having this scratchy old performance with noises off and coughs? And in fact, it was broadcast first in 1949. But when you hear the tenor do that crescendo halfway through, you suddenly realise that this is a historic recording.
It's 1949. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
We heard Ferruccio Tagliavini singing Nemorino. I sort of felt Tagliavini married rather nicely, pasta and wine, which, given your your mention of Glyndebourne just now, singing Una furtiva lagrima from L'Elisia d'Amore by Donizetti. The Metropolitan Opera Orchestra was directed by Giuseppe Antonicelli. I somehow felt that Wagner was going to enter into your list, Simon Hoggart, because I remember reading you being very taken, quite recently, I think, by a performance of Tristan.
Yes, that's right. We were in Edinburgh, going to the Usher Hall every night, and also a chance to catch up with everything else going on at the festival. But the climax, the high spot, was the performance, sung, not acted, of Tristan and Isolde, featuring Jennifer Wilson from suburban Washington, D.C. But, of course, one of the things when you sit through about, and this was 5 hours we were in the Usher Hall, is that it's as if the whole thing is building up snatch by snatch towards this thunderous climax in which everything that you've already heard comes together. And, well, the place just erupted after Ms. Wilson had finished singing, and I'm not at all surprised. It was just marvellous. We're not hearing her now, but this is a piece of music which, frankly, almost I could sing, really, that it is so robust, so thunderous, so billowing, so mighty. It just drags the singer almost along in its wake.
Thank you.
Nina Stemmer sang the Liebeslied from Tristan and Isolde, Act 3, Scene 3, by Wagner, with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Antonio Papano. Well, Simon Hoggart, thank you for rounding off your choice with something which perhaps cannot be topped in some ways, that it takes one to the top of the edifice, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, follow that might have been coined for that. Ludicrous to say that anyone could sing it, but I do feel with great vocal music that very often either the orchestra, the music, or the singer is in charge. And with the Donizetti, you feel very much that it's a singer who's imposing himself on the aria, whereas with this, you feel that it's the orchestra that's demanding, is pushing the singer along, and she's trying desperately to keep up, you know, like almost like a cork on waves in a stormy sea. Absolutely wonderful experience.
Well, I think it's quite a marriage of the two, actually. Of course, that music has been performed in an entirely orchestral version, and as you say, it's very, very powerful. But when you put the voice on top, It has sort of overwhelming, transcending quality. Well, thank you very much, Simon Hoggart, for letting us hear, rather than your political sketches, your musical sketches and the music that you love.
I couldn't do a Desert Island Politicians, I don't think.
Simon Hoggart was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the actor Stephen Tomkinson. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
On BBC One, over millions of years, life in the oldest continent has struggled, evolved and triumphed into the most spectacular show on Earth. From the dead centre of the Sahara to the tip of Cape of Good Hope. From the barren mountains of the Atlas to the riches of the Congo rainforest. Africa remains, as ever, the most surprising continent of them all. Join me, David Attenborough, for Africa. Wednesday night at 9 on BBC One and BBC One HD.
You're listening to BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio, and you can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. If you've recently tuned in, a very good afternoon to you from me, Jonathan Swain. In a couple of minutes, today's early music show. But now, with the time at 2 minutes past one, a summary of the news. The former Labour Sports Minister, Jerry Sutcliffe, says members of the New Year's Honours Committee have made a big mistake in failing to recognise more Paralympic athletes. He says the failure to put Paralympians on an equal footing with the Olympic medal winners has left a sour taste in the mouths of athletes such as David Weir and Lee Pearson, who've expressed disappointment at the apparent disparity. Mr Sutcliffe said a missed opportunity it was. Labour has dismissed David Cameron's claim that Britain is heading in the right direction, insisting that the economy is failing and the Prime Minister is out of touch. In his New Year message, David Cameron described 2012 as a great year, but a tough one too. Opposition groups in Syria say government forces have killed more than 200 people in the central city of Homs. There are reports which can't be verified that people living in a rebel-held area, including women and children, were rounded up and killed. In Pakistan, 19 people have been killed in a car bomb attack on a convoy of 3 buses carrying Shia Muslim pilgrims. Witnesses said one of the vehicles caught fire and was completely destroyed. The Home Office has insisted public confidence in the police service remains high despite recent controversies. It was responding to a warning from the Labour chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee, Keith Vaz, who said public faith in the police had been shaken by what he called a dangerous cocktail of events, including evidence of a police cover-up over the Hillsborough disaster and the row involving the former chief whip Andrew Mitchell and officers in Downing Street. The Bishop of Sheffield has spoken of a sense of shock and outrage in the city about the death of a church organist who died after being attacked on his way to midnight mass on Christmas Eve. Alan Greaves, who was 68, was discovered badly beaten close to his church. At a service this morning held to give thanks for his life, Mr. Greaves' widow, Maureen, said she hadn't stopped crying over what she described as the evil that has been done. And the weather. Scattered showers will continue over parts of northern England, Wales and Scotland this afternoon, with a band of heavy rain moving in from Northern Ireland by early evening. It'll remain largely dry elsewhere, with some sunny spells mainly in eastern England. Tonight will be wet and windy again across many northern and western areas, drier but rather cloudy elsewhere. Radio 3 News and Weather at 1:05. And it's time now to join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show.
Welcome to the show. We're focusing today on one of early music's great characters, an actress and singer who was a huge celebrity in her day, a star of the London theatres whose powerful voice and daring wit fascinated audiences for decades. Her name is Kitty Clive. And we're going to hear examples of some of the music she made famous. Rule Britannia was one, along with some of Handel's most gorgeous arias and lots more. And we're also going to hear about some of the people she met in the course of her glittering career. Music from Handel's pastoral ode L'Allegro il Penseroso ed il Moderato. That was the air Mirth, Admit Me of Thy Crew, performed there by Clara McFadden with the King's Consort, directed by Robert King. It was the soprano Kitty Clive that audiences would have heard singing that piece if they'd been lucky enough to get a ticket for the performance of the work at Lincoln's Inn Fields Theatre in January 1740. Kitty Clive was the hot ticket of the day. And with me in the studio to discuss her colourful life and work is the musicologist Berta Jonkers, who's currently writing a book about the great 18th century soprano. Thank you so